Meet John and Alex. John is the textbook definition of a candidate for the traditional executive role. He's built his career on efficiency by cutting costs, streamlining operations, and ensuring quarterly profits always stay in the green. His focus? Stability. Then there's Alex. She started in the same corporate environment, but saw things a bit differently. Instead of just optimizing the existing business, she constantly experimented with new ideas. She created a small innovation lab within her department, tested customer-driven solutions, and pushed for disruptive ideas. Some of them failed, but a few ideas made quite a nice impact. When economic shifts and new technologies disrupted their industry, John found himself scrambling. His department, so focused on efficiency, had no room for agility. Meanwhile, Alex had already positioned herself differently for the future. She had built a small culture of experimentation, strategic risk-taking, and creative problem-solving. And when the board needed a new executive, guess who got the call? Alex's story isn't fiction. It's the emerging reality of corporate leadership. Today's top executives are efficiency-driven, but tomorrow's leaders will be the ones who embrace creativity, innovation, and calculated risk. They will be business model architects, not just operators. Join me in this episode as I explore together with Dan Palmer why innovation management is the defining skill for future executives and what today's managers must do to stay ahead of the curve. Welcome to Change That Works, a podcast by ICG about change, leadership, and innovation that takes you behind the scenes. Today's host will be Alexandra Popescu-Zorica. Dan Palmer is a seasoned professional with experience in innovation strategy, launching new ventures, and helping global companies think like startups again. Dan started his career on Wall Street, where his employer was the first bank to collapse in the 2008 financial crisis. He spent 4 years on the exchange floor making markets in derivatives before transitioning to financial technology with the New York Stock Exchange. He's fascinated by all things startup related, and after getting his MBA, he joined a boutique consultancy to help some of the biggest businesses on the planet compete in a quickly changing competitive landscape. Dan is an American living in Finland. He is currently working with ICG in Otimi, where he is on a mission to help Europe increase its innovation output and be recognized as the place to go for new products, services, and ideas. Dan, welcome to Change That Works.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So you heard me talking about Alex and John a little bit earlier. I want to ask you, how far off is the story that I just presented about those two persons, John and Alex?
It's not that far off. I do think that a lot of times some companies are getting better, but the story you presented does definitely ring true to me because businesses tend to be a little bit afraid of new stuff. And so they stick with what they know and they go with the efficiency or the people who are managing things the way that they're used to.
Are there more Johns in the companies or more of Alex?
I think that more often than not, most people are John in this example. And a lot of that has to do with what we've come to think of as what businesses do. When I think about my time getting an MBA, it was a lot about efficiency and operations and, you know, the financial and accounting stuff. And only barely did we touch on anything innovation related or entrepreneurial. I think a lot of that has to do with the difficulty of teaching newness in the event that you have a new world-changing idea. That probably only works once, right? You're only going to be able to change the world in that particular way one time. And so it's a little bit difficult, I think, for business people to, you know, understand what innovation is, what that means, and how it is that they can bring that to the forefront and make those new products or services or business models that their company might be needing because they don't really understand what it is that it looks like.
So you mentioned MBA and that made me think a lot about the formal education that most people who become managers, directors, executives have. And this formal education is rather preparing us to lead a company towards efficiency and profitability, which of course are very important to keeping the lights on. But on the other hand, it kind of creates a certain mindset that it's not that prone or favorable towards innovation.
Yes, that is definitely one of the drawbacks to our current educational system, is it is probably the least progressive in terms of doing new stuff of any industry whatsoever. Some of that is the way we've set it up, but also because we learn by doing and we go to school to learn from what other people have done, that creates a situation where what schools teach is things that have already proven to be successful. And for a very long time, efficiency was the key driver of business. So we have this curriculum of the last 80 to 100 years of what it takes to run a business. And, you know, we learned about efficiency and operations and supply chains and whatever, because those used to be an incredible struggle. I think as we move forward and those things are still very, very important, are no longer a mystery or no longer a competitive advantage. They're just becoming the basic necessity to run a business. And yet that is kind of what formal education is teaching us, is these are the important things, and not necessarily paying attention to how the world is changing around us.
So thinking about Alex, is he or she, no matter how we want to refer to, an accident in the corporate world? Because definitely our Alex from the story exhibited different behaviors and he or she chose a different path. And what specific skills or habits are setting these leaders like Alex to be innovation driven?
Yeah, in this story, this is interesting because Alex is in a kind of a precarious position. And it has been my experience that people like Alex end up leaving the corporate environment and going off to start something new, that he or she may eventually get tired of the lack of progress that they're seeing and throw their hands up or some choice words for their managers and depart. So there really kind of is, to your point, a fundamental mismatch between the corporate environment and the corporate culture and these people who are innovative and entrepreneurial, because currently those skill sets and those mindsets and that attitude is not particularly prized.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think it's unfortunate, and it's honestly one of the bigger failings of the corporate environment that we find ourselves in, is they tend to drive those people out. And then several years later, they end up buying the startups that in this case, Alex would have started for tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. And it actually ends up being kind of destructive of value. So instead of kind of growing and nurturing these people in-house, they drive them out, and then they eventually are forced to purchase them as competitors.
Well, lucky Alex.
Yeah, I mean, it is good for Alex, although it's got to be tough in the moment, because it seems to me that, you know, he or she was possibly the person that this company needed. And unfortunately, the management or the board of the directors or whomever was the ultimate decision maker on who was going to lead this company didn't quite understand that, and then was forced to pay for it later. When you think about this from a purely business perspective, this is bad return on investment. Instead of taking the chance on Alex here and investing the time and resources required to, you know, make a company more innovative, they decided to stick with what they know, and then they end up purchasing, you know, at full retail price later what they could have had in-house.
Probably this train of thoughts doesn't really happen in a company, especially if the executives are changing or the board of directors are changing. So Alex is leaving, she's starting her own company, and then after a few years, they are buying her. Maybe some people remember, oh, Alex was part of the team. I think that would be like an ideal way of going through the process and understanding that, okay, we made a strategic mistake or strategic move there by not recognizing Alex's potential and her ideas and nurturing them in the inside. But okay, we made a great deal. We got Alex back. Okay, we got her business back into the company. This is progress and so on. The ideal ways, or what you were saying about keeping Alex, keeping persons like Alex in the company, I think that goes down to two very important dimensions. One is about the culture of experimentation and innovation, something that needs to be really built and nurtured in organizations because it doesn't come natural to many companies and executives. And the other part is about the way that we manage to balance the short-term thinking with the long-term thinking, how we manage to balance efficiency with creativity and developing things that are new, that are totally unfamiliar to us. So I'm thinking now about the managers that are right now in organizations, in their roles. And what would you say to them? How can they really balance this need for short-term operational efficiency, which is being asked of them, but also with the long-term innovation and experimentation that companies need in order to survive in the near future?
There's a lot to unpack there. You know, to your point, I think a lot of times companies don't know what entrepreneurialism or innovation looks like, and so they don't necessarily recognize that potential. So that is a problem. The second problem is, you know, innovation is risk. And executives are like hardwired to avoid risk, right? They see risk as a bad thing, and that's not always the case. But the third point, and to me the most interesting, is how do you balance the time frame, right? How do you balance the short-term thinking of, hey, we need to keep the lights on, with the long-term thinking of, are we going to be around in 10 years? And I don't know that there's a magic bullet for that. I think that for a lot of companies, they are myopically focused on the short term because they're publicly traded companies, and every 90 days, they have to give a report to the markets to say what it is they've been doing. And some of those long-term projects, you know, aren't going to have an immediate positive effect. They actually may have a negative effect. Some of these projects are going to fail, and the markets may not necessarily care about that. So that in and of itself might be just kind of a function of the, you know, Western style capitalism that we find ourselves in might end up harming our innovative potential, particularly if we work for a large company. The other interesting challenge is a lot of executives tend to be towards the latter half or the end of their careers, right? So they also are looking at this saying, hey, I only have 5, I only have 10 years left. I don't want to totally reinvent the wheel here at my company because that seems like a lot of work and I don't know the outcome. And I understand that. I would probably make the same decision if I were in their shoes, right? Of like, hey, I've only got a few years left, let's just run the clock out. But the challenge is that, you know, whomever comes afterwards is also going to be in that same situation of, hey, I don't want to change. Let's just keep the smooth sailing going. And it causes corporations to fall behind. As far as, you know, how to encourage that experimentation, that space that people need for innovation, I think it is going to require a pretty significant shift in corporate mindset, right? In managerial thinking. Because as I mentioned earlier, short-term thinking, short-term projects fund your paycheck, but long-term or innovation funds your pension. And we need to, you know, talk to, or we need to drive that idea home of this is your legacy or this is your pension or something to get people out of the idea that I only need to worry about what's happening today and start thinking about what's going to happen tomorrow. It's an interesting conundrum. And a lot of times I think corporations have their hand forced. And as we talked about earlier, it's, you know, a new startup shows up, rethinks the way that business should be run, gets a lot of media attention, makes a lot of money, and then a big corporation comes in and purchases them at a premium, either to get that information that they could have had the entire time, or to put them out of business and start the cycle over again.
While you were talking, I was thinking about the companies that I refer to as innovative. And what I find in those companies is that in most of them, the founder is still alive and still in charge. So, you know, about the person that wants to retire, I think from your own company, you might have a different mindset when you approach retirement. You might still want to reinvent the wheel because this is something that you created from scratch. This is your baby. But with companies where the founder is long gone or exited or whatever scenario, I think maybe people that are in charge are not that emotionally connected to the business, to the vision. It's a job. It's probably the difference between a job and the dream, something that you created on your own. And for me, now also doing my PhD on innovation management, I've found this in many discussions and interviews to be one of the fundamental differences between companies that are younger, have been born in most of them in the US, where we see this drive for innovation. But that's because, yes, the founders are still alive and pretty much in charge. Whereas to the older continent and the older companies where that's no longer the case. Would you sympathize with this opinion or?
To an extent, yes. I think that there are a lot of people who view their career just as a job, right? They are not emotionally invested. It's a position that I've been in before, right? Where it's just like show up at 9, leave at 5, collect a paycheck, because at that time, that was what mattered to me. And I didn't necessarily have the passion or the vision for the company because I wasn't truly invested. The difference, I think, and you pointed it out here earlier, is the founders have a vision that is truly just theirs. They may try to communicate it and to a varying degree it might work, but it's really, there's something about them that they may never stop, right? For them, it'll never be enough. And that's good in some cases. In other cases, you can see, you know, you look at like Jeff Bezos, you know, things start going sideways because he doesn't know when to let go. But to your point, yeah, it's how is it that you kind of inspire your workers, your management, your board of directors to want to do something that is a little bit unsafe and go out and innovate? Because it is very uncertain. It is adding risk into the business equation. And generally, that's something that they avoid at all costs.
And also, you avoid what you don't know. And coming back to your first insight about the MBA, if we don't learn about innovation and if we are not educated in what innovation management is versus, let's say, the traditional management or operational management, it's probably very difficult to start something that you don't know, that you don't have the skill set for that. You might even have the mindset, but if you're lacking the skill set and the tool set, that's going to be difficult. And thinking that maybe one way to get around to this topic and one way to increase this openness and the result that organizations get from innovation is really to educate people on what innovation is and how they can manage innovation, which is totally different than how they manage the day-to-day business.
Yes, that is true. But to your point, I actually want to disagree. This is something that we're all capable of. It's something that we've all gone through, right? No one was born as a 28-year-old business executive with all the information that they needed, right? There was this period of trial and experimentation as we've all gone through to figure out, you know, very basic things from, you know, how to walk and what food we like to what we want to do with the rest of our lives. So it is something that's kind of inherent in the human condition. And at least within corporations, it seems to me that they start to lose that. They do stick with the things that they know. And, you know, that's part of kind of the challenge of the educational system. But I don't think that it's not that we lack the skill set, the mindset, or the tool set. It is more that we have kind of let them atrophy, that this is a natural behavior that we somehow have decided not to embrace. And instead, we go for the cold, hard numbers of, you know, accounting and operations and efficiency because they're easier to predict. So, you know, to your point, I do think that we need to celebrate more innovations. And in particular, I think that we need to celebrate more of the small innovations, right? When somebody invents Facebook, we all notice. But there's also, you know, innovations happening every day on much, much smaller scales that we really should take some time to celebrate and say, hey, Bob thought of a new way of doing this, and this has reduced our expenditure or, you know, increased our output or whatever the result is. And also kind of take those as great examples of the benefits of innovation and not necessarily just the huge disruptive innovation that, you know, kind of rewrites history.
Yeah. I'm stubborn. I'm going back to education. So. That gets me a bit back to people getting the information and maybe in a way the structure of, okay, what innovation is, like you said. Because if the intrinsic expectation is that for me to innovate, I have to invent a new company, a new business model, I have to whatever, then that thing might hold me back because I'm in a risk-averse environment. I'm in an environment where there's a lot of emphasis on control, on predictability. And so I'm imagining this future that looks great, but I have literally no clue how to get there. And it also seems very risky. So then my natural tendency might be that, okay, I will just do what I have to do to get my job well done and probably get a promotion if I'm excellent at that. But if someone comes and tells me and explains to me, okay, you can innovate, maybe at a smaller scale, this is how you can do it. And those smaller scales will add up and educate you on how to do things differently. You might sometimes or even go to that big innovation.
To your point, the systems are generally not in place for people who are naturally innovative to be able to innovate within a corporate environment. And a lot of them may not really understand what it is. Of course, there is the Big Bang disruptive innovation, and I think we all recognize that. But at its heart, innovation is really just about experimentation and exploration. So if you can give managers or employees enough time, really honestly some downtime, to think about the aspects of their jobs that they don't like or the things that they think could be better, and just enough space to kind of explore what that means, you're going to have these small pockets of innovation that are going to naturally arise as people start to question, hey, why are we doing it like this? The results are fine, but they could be better. Or maybe my experiment fails. Like, that is also okay. I hate quoting Thomas Edison, but it's, I haven't failed. I've just found 10,000 ways that don't work yet. And it's kind of that idea of like, you don't really know until you try, but if you keep doing the same thing over and over again and you're expecting drastic improvement, that just seems like insanity to me.
Mm-hmm. I used to refer to that quote quite a lot when I was in corporate. And at a certain point, my CFO said, let's not get that literal about the 10,000 ways, right? So it's just an example. You've mentioned failure, and I think there is a lot of aversion towards failure. And we've done in the Change That Works another episode debating a lot on the topic of failure and how it's in organizations. But I think this is a question about failure that remains open and there is a lot of talk about. And I would really like to get your thoughts on how should managers and executives approach failure within innovation efforts? And, you know, what can they do to actually learn from these unsuccessful initiatives? Not hide them away, not be ashamed of them, but recognize them, learn from them, and keep on trying.
That's a good question. And it's something I've noticed is more prevalent here in Europe than it was in the US, is this fear of failure. And part of me understands it, right? It sucks to fail. It's not an enjoyable process for anyone. But I would like to think that honestly, I am who I am now through a series of failures. Right? You go and you figure out what works and what doesn't, and you have to be kind of brave enough to go out there and try. And so to your point, I think that the way that companies kind of incentivize or celebrate things, it's easy to celebrate the wins, right? But what we should be doing is celebrating the tries. And yes, there is going to be some failure in there. And as long as that failure doesn't end up being fatal, then it's a learning experience. It's a chance for a company to say, hey, we tried something new and our customers didn't like it, but we quickly changed back and they all came back, right? And now we know that's not the way forward for us, right? We still want to grow and we want to change, but we definitely need to avoid making that same mistake. Because I think a lot of customers and clients will tolerate mistakes. Nobody's perfect. I make mistakes all the time. It's when you don't learn from those mistakes and you make the same ones over and over again that you find that I think your customers start to leave.
And also to maybe help managers and executives understand this dimension of mistake. Mistake equals learning, and that it's also not a career suicide. Because I think many times, or at least in my discussions with ambitious managers who want to see something different, who would like to drive change, there is a big fear that if I fail, I may not be the next in line for a promotion.
Yeah. There's definitely some psychology that goes into it, right? And the idea that people need to be psychologically safe and, you know, have the ability to express their opinions or ideas, I think is very important. But I hate saying this, but I think a lot of innovation really comes from the top. And it's not necessarily that the CEO is hanging out in her garage inventing something new, but really creating an environment where you say, you know what, we're a learning organization and we realize that we're going to do some things that may not work out, right? That's why this is an experiment and not a certain thing. The idea is you can go out and you can try stuff. And as long as you are getting something from it, even if it isn't positive towards revenue, then we as a company are in a better position than we were yesterday.
Circling back to how we started this episode about how you become a leader, how you become an executive, the school that you are going to. And looking into the future and imagining that there is going to be a tipping point where keeping things the same way as they were, it's not going to work. And I'm wondering, and I'm curious for myself and for our listeners, how does the executive of the future look like in terms of skill, attitude, mindset?
Wow. Yeah. I wish I had tomorrow's newspaper. I think that when we look forward, the business landscape is not going to look anything like it does today. Whether this is imposed upon them, you know, by the government or whether it's imposed upon them by, you know, the political climate that they find themselves in, or big things like climate change and just, you know, finding out, hey, we can't farm this input anymore because it just doesn't grow here. So when I think about what businesses look like in the future, I see them as smaller. I see them as more agile. And I see them as prioritizing things in the long run. Because I think short-term thinking is why we're kind of in this situation in the first place. And so, you know, the executives of the future are going to have systems in place where they're not being rewarded off of our quarterly or annual profit, but more something that has a bit more of a long-term view to it, where they're, you know, people respond to incentives. And so if you incentivize somebody to say, hey, we're looking for the maximal growth over the next quarter century, you're going to have people who make decisions differently than the ones that are worried about the next fiscal quarter. I think that also, you know, with the advent of Gen AI and I'm sure future developments, we're going to run into situations where the value of the specialist starts to disappear, where it's kind of the comeback of the generalist, where people who know a little bit about a wide variety of topics are going to be the ones that you're going to want leading your company, because things change very, very rapidly. And, you know, you might have spent several decades getting your PhD in innovation management, and then maybe tomorrow that's no longer a challenge and you're going to have people who spent their time learning about, you know, a whole bunch of different stuff might find themselves in a better position. So As far as, you know, what the executive looks like, I don't really know. But I do think that we're quickly approaching a tipping point where the things that used to work actually just ground to a halt, right? I don't think they work as well as they used to. And eventually they're going to stop working altogether, and business is going to have their hands forced to make these changes. And then whoever survives that Lord of the Flies situation, I don't really know.
I had an interesting discussion with someone involved in learning and development. She was a program director at a very big tech company. And she was telling me that pretty soon AI will run the day-to-day business and we will need more creative people, more innovation to create the business of the future. I don't know if that's the case. I mean, I'm sure she also didn't have tomorrow's newspaper when we had this talk. But I do sympathize with the fact that the things that are repeatable, the things that are acquirable in a certain amount of time, you know, that expertise, that level of being an expert in something might be at risk because of the new technologies, because of AI. And businesses and companies will need to embrace more the creative thinking, the innovation, the experimentation, trying new things, inventing new things, new ways of working, new ways of doing business, business models, and so on.
I mean, I don't know that I'm ready to give up the fight against our future robot overlords right now, but it's certainly looking like they're going to end up winning. There are some things that AI or computers do far better than we will ever do as humans. And so things that are repeatable, things that, you know, require a clear, logical path to reach a solution are going to be things that the computer does. The challenge I think that AI is going to have, and this goes to your point, is it's hard to program in the idea of go do something new, because that's not necessarily how computers run. They might be making weird connections in their black box and providing you with information that seems creative. And to an extent, it is. But I don't think that we're going to reach this point anytime soon where AI is coming up with new and novel ideas without a human behind the keyboard pushing it to do things that it isn't normally programmed to do. So to your point, yes, I think that the future of human employment is going to be things like creativity and art, because that I think that's our kind of our natural state. And it's not something, at least at the moment, that computers can do except by brute force. But that doesn't really solve any problems for, you know, a typical business when you're like, hey, give me an idea, and the computer magically says, here's all the ideas. Because that doesn't put me in a better position than not having any ideas at all. It's being able to have somebody who said, hey, I made this weird connection, and it's based off of not only the information that I had in my head, but the weather outside today and how I'm feeling. And I suddenly just, something just clicked. And I invented this new business model. And I think we should go out and we should test this in the real world.
I really like this last thoughts of yours. And we are getting very close to the end of our episode. I wanted to add something, but it's not adding value to what to what you said. And I really like, I would really like to close our episode with these thoughts of yours, which are very positive. And I think they're very encouraging for everybody. Also, I believe in our human nature to be creative. This is what got us here through creativity. And I'm really excited about a future where all of us will get the opportunity to rediscover that in ourselves and use it to our maximum potential. Thank you, Dan, so much for being here today with Change That Works. And the future looks quite creative and innovative.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. Change That Works seeks to inspire a different way to transform organizations. Let's tune in again for our next episode.